Do you want to talk about how you're feeling right now?
Oh, so many questions. What does this mean? What do I do?
Go on! Tell them what you think!
I liked it.
I think your calculations may have been off.
I think it's all right.
I just have a lot of feelings.
This pleases me.
These are perfectly normal feelings.
Do you even know what you sound like when you talk like that?
Now, shall we begin?
Hey there, Real Phils fans. Welcome back to another episode of the Real Phils podcast. We are
back, baby.
I am so excited to be back in action with my two good besties for some real episodes.
Anything goes.
Anything goes. And you know what? I was trying to think of an intro for this, and I'm like, man, I don't want it to be funny. I love like the sobering factor of like how real this is for me to like have a real episode back in recording action for this.
Oh.
I'm fucking happy again. This is great. So
it
occurred to me, you know, rewatching the movie, and it just kind of brought up a memory with my dad. And we would watch this movie all the time. And I loved the fact that he would get so into the fact of playing the villain. He would always like grip his hand and he would come at my brother and I, and he would just like latch down on our chest, and he would just be like, Lima. He would like shake his hand.
Hum nub should I? Hum nub should I?
Be like, it's the claw. Oh, it's gonna get you. So yeah, rewatching this, it was nice to revisit it again. And yeah, I'm just excited. So guys, if this is your first time joining us,
I thought you're gonna be like a first time watching this movie.
No,
I was like, I was raised on Black Root.
Ladies and gentlemen,
out of my way, Packer.
If this is your side note, Warwick Davis's wife died. That's sad. Sad. That's sad kind of news. Now that you mentioned Black Root,
Kaya,
Kaya.
We gathered these condolences in the forest.
But ladies and gentlemen, if this is your first time joining us here on the Real Phils podcast, we are a movie review show that meets every 2 weeks. What are you laughing at?
No, I'm giggling.
Oh, okay. I'm reminding people. We review a movie every 2 weeks of a different genre, of a different kind.
Fortnightly.
Oh, there it is!
Fortnightly.
It's back. It's back. So yeah, guys, thank you for joining us. Today's genre is my anthropology movie. And
anthropology or archaeology?
It is anthropology, but archaeology is like a subset of anthropology. So that's why I'm making it work. I'm pulling a Jack.
Hey, all right.
Yeah. So we've already done one Indiana Jones, but how about second Indiana Jones?
We're counting backwards in production.
Yes.
But not necessarily the timeline, because Temple of Doom is a prequel.
It is.
That takes place, I believe, 1 or 2 years before Raiders of the Lost Ark, and I think 3 years before, 3 or 4 years before The Last Crusade.
Right. So we, guys, we have 1984's Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, directed by Mr. Steven Spielberg, and I love this movie. And I cannot, I mean, obviously assume that I know for myself, I know Jack obviously has already spiked his opinion in saying, I've been raised on Black Root.
I was raised on this.
And I know that Nathan, this is not his first time watching. And hopefully, guys, all of you out there, it is not your first time, but it is your first time. You want to hit pause on this episode. You want to go watch that movie. Disney Plus has it. Go watch the movie. Come back. Listen to our episode. And just enjoy yourselves.
Mumbo, jumbo, bring me some Sankara stones.
Bean footage?
Yeah. Oh, the bean footage.
This is more of a soy footage.
Doll footage?
Doll footage?
Lentil
footage. Anything goes. Footage.
Listen, this is more podcasts that they get in a week. These people are starving.
The old legend of the Shankara stones. The villager's sacred rock was taken.
Village stories, Dr. Jones.
Fortune and glory, kid. Fortune and glory.
No, do you?
Archaeologists were always funny little men searching for their mummies.
Mummies.
I did try to like come up with something where it's all like, what do you mean? What movie? Who the genre you just chose? but no, it wasn't coming to me. But yeah. This is, and I don't care how blasphemous it is. This is my favorite Indiana Jones film.
That's okay.
That doesn't mean I think it's the best, but it is my favorite.
I think it adds to the original trilogy as a whole, but it also does have a bit of the redheaded stepchild stigma attached to it. Because it had mixed feelings initially.
Initially, yes.
And it's also, by the creators themselves, a dark, dark movie.
Inspired by their horrid marriages.
Well, yeah, Spielberg had broken up with his girlfriend, and Lucas was going through a divorce at the time. Plus, Lucas also wanted to make it darker in the same vein that Empire Strikes Back was. Yes,
respectful.
Because that was a success, and they were like, hey, so let's keep going.
You got two kind of like guys that are in like a hateful period of their lives, and you get Temple of Doom out the end of it. It's certainly a good Indiana Jones movie, but it's sort of like if you bite into like a rack of lamb or a lamb chop, and you get a little bit of that gaminess. Some people like it, some people don't, but right in the middle of this film is some real gamey shits. I mean,
but it's almost like smoothed out with some mint jelly.
Not all of it. Yeah.
Some. But even in retrospect, as a grown adult, you know, watching Indy get beat up and tortured, and then force fed the black blood, and then we've got every 80s movie should
good fight scene.
Child torture. Child on child torture.
As one does.
Yeah. But the very center of this movie is not very pleasant. The beginning is wonderful. The end is great. But there is some hard feelings, I think, in that middle portion of the movie. It gets pretty fucking dark. Even more dark and disturbing, and I think more scary than Poltergeist.
No. Two movies that just like traumatized me as a child.
Yeah, but Poltergeist is almost lighter.
Almost, until a man starts peeling his face in the bathroom.
Oh, yeah, but it doesn't have human sacrifice.
I mean,
and like the children, at least, like they're like putting on their best face, like, he got bit.
Mostly. Yeah. No, it.
And to cut Nathan off, I'm very sorry to finish my thought. This movie was also responsible for one of the movies that was responsible for why we have a PG-13 rating.
It was like the tiny snowball that got it all going.
Makes sense. And
yeah, no, it does.
This is not my favorite by any means. This is definitely mid-pack of the Indiana Jones family. This is the middle child. And only because, two mistake of children's came after it with Crystal Skull and what is the newest one?
Dial of Destiny?
I haven't watched Dial.
I kind of like the Dial of Destiny.
I mean, I would put Dial of Destiny like over Crystal Skull.
Sure.
Yeah, I would definitely put it. But I mean, that's not a hard thing. That's not a hard thing to do. But then again, I would still rank Dial of Destiny as fourth.
Yeah, 100%.
So I mean, it's just they're basically just swapping.
Yeah.
And Doom was not... was not in, like, I think the wheelhouse of... I watched 1 and 3 a lot growing up. But for some reason, maybe it's because my parents, like, watched 2 and they're like, eh, a little bit too much. Maybe, you know, we'll skip this one. But I watched, you know, this much later in life than I probably saw the other ones. I remember watching Raiders of the Lost Ark... and having to, like, I was supposed to, like, look away during the, when the plane, like, dices up the big boxer guy. Like, oh, this part, like, there's a lot of blood.
Who also plays the slave master in Temple of Doom.
A lot of callbacks.
I agree with that, Nathan, but we didn't have Raiders of the Lost Ark in our home on VHS. We had recorded off of HBO Temple of Doom. And then this is sort of before Last Crusade had come out in 1989. So my only real exposure to, besides seeing Raiders a couple of times, was we had Temple of Doom, which we watched ad nauseum. which, looking back, I'm like, why were you watching this movie? It is a great movie. It's a great movie. But again... very dark subject material compared to some of the other Indiana Jones movies.
Again, it's a lot of fun. There's some good moments. And like I said, a lot of callbacks, a lot of little...
And don't humph me, Drew. Why did you pick Temple of Doom? Was it for his glory or for yours?
Drew, why this one? Why not anything else?
I honestly...
You got Mummy out of the way. So.
I had already got Mummy out of the way.
Okay, thank you very much. Mummy's a fucking great film. You're on the wrong side of the river, Jack.
You mean the 1996 cinematic masterpiece, The Mummy, or was it 1999.
So I desperately was kind of like racking my brain, thinking like, oh my gosh, what do I do? What do I do for
Scorpion
anthropology King? and you know, kind of like veering into like archaeology kind of thing. And it did almost open it up for the doors of The Mummy, but then I got the, you know, Mummy movie, and I was like, well, that's an obvious pick. That's an obvious going to go there. And, you know, I've always loved Temple of Doom. I just thought it has just been like the nacho cheese of the Indiana Jones franchise, which is still
I would see it as like the scattering of pickled jalapeno slices on the nachos. I think the nacho cheese is Last Crusade.
I would agree. And Doom.
I think there's more shtick to this, though.
Well, and Spielberg did that because he was like, this movie is so dark and fucking depressive that, you know, they threw in a lot of stuff to lighten it up.
Because, I mean, just the dinner scene at the palace where, you know, he's like, oh, snake surprise. I love her pale, like, what's the surprise? That's an open, and it's all eels. He's just like, eating scarabs? The eels, like slurping out the bugs, which it was like pudding in the bugs, and the same thing in the monkey heads. He's like chilled monkey brains. It was also again like pudding
there's the nice soup, with the eyeballs and
the eyeballs were glued to the bottom.
Not glued. They used like suction cups.
Okay, yeah, because you can see how like hard. If you actually like focus on it, she's like scraping the bottom of the bowl, and that's why like they suddenly just pop up. I don't know. There's so much to this, but there's also like a lot that is presented, but it's not exactly explained. And I also find myself just not questioning why it's not explained, like. when he says, like, oh, I thought the palace had been emptied since, you know, like 1850. And they're like, no, you know, there's a new Maharaja. And they go there and he's all like, ah, so many unexpected guests. And you think he's just referring to Indy. And he probably is Indy and like the colonel. But then you see all these other guests inside and you're like, who are they? Where are they from? Are they like royalty? Are they military? Are they government officials? Like, why are they here? I thought maybe a little bit of, I don't know, some type of insight as to who they were would be great. Like introductions to some other characters besides like the right hand man. And the colonel.
We could have used more from the very cultured British accent of like the Maharaja's majordomo or whatever.
It's like, oh, the British, they do like to treat us like children. They never forget the uprising of 1853.
It is unusual to insult one's dinner's guest. But this movie was also a little bit controversial from the point of view of India. And the Indians. They had tried to negotiate shooting everything in India. And the Indian government thought the script was racist, which it does have some elements of that.
To that note, it was banned in India.
It still is.
No. Until it came out on VHS.
Well,
then there was the ability to actually have it.
And then they wanted the right to the final cut. So they ended up shooting it in Myanmar. Or no, Sri Lanka.
Yeah.
Sri Lanka. But I always thought that it was dramatic pause from the, you must go to Pangkat Palace. But it was Steven Spielberg feeding the lines to the Sri Lankan actor who doesn't speak English.
No English.
And he's miming it back phonetically. Wow. So it's not dramatic pause from this guy. He's waiting for Spielberg to give him the rest of the lines off camera, which is kind of neat.
So not only like repeating the lines that he's doing, but also like, you know, obviously the same tone and emphasis and stuff, because unless you're told that, I don't think he would have known at all. I think he does a fabulous job. And there was a moment where when he says like,
perfectly, yeah.
And he like covers his eyes. That was actually Spielberg going, that was Spielberg wiping his head. And he mimicked it. But it works perfectly.
It does. It does.
It's so, I don't know.
The
it's,
storm.
This is just such a fun thing. The dress at the beginning cost so much money because it had to be made so detailed.
Well, and it was made using period beads.
Right.
And material from the 1930s.
Oh. And the intro took twice as long to record because at one point an elephant ate half the dress.
Yes.
And they had to fly it out to get it fixed again. And then not that recording was delayed, but recording had to continue on without Indiana because he had a herniated disc. And he had to go and have surgery and recover for 6 weeks. So all of the back shots from like all the filming from the backside of Indy while he's in all these fights, stunt double. Mm-hmm. And then Indy came back and filmed the front side where he's, you know, you see his face as he's punching the big guard or whatever.
And Harrison Ford also knew that he was going to be doing the majority of this, at least the center part of the film, shirtless. So he was, you know, had put himself on this high intensity workout regimen. And the trainer that was with Harrison Ford thought he would join him as in solidarity. And he stopped doing it as intensively as Harrison Ford was doing. So Harrison Ford credits his speedy recovery for being in like the best goddamn shape of his life.
Yeah.
And like, I looking back, I think that's probably one of the reasons why my mom didn't flinch so much at a lot of some of the material. Because, you know, this movie came out in 1984. I was watching it by the time I was 4 years old, born in 1982. Watching, you know, plop down in front of the television, put in the old VHS, and Jack eats his grilled cheese and his chippies after, like, you know, preschool or something. This was the movie, one of the movies that would be put on.
Jack just says, hold on, pause it. I got to go to the bathroom. And Jack's mom goes, uh-huh. Take as much time as you need, bud. Take as much time as you need.
In fact, I'm going to rewind
Wait,
it a little.
Forward a little bit. There we go. Right there. There we
Fortune
go.
Fortune and glory, Jack.
Fortune and glory.
Fortune and glory.
As a kid. Oh, sorry, what?
Oh, you go first.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, like, as a kid, the villain was one of the key people that, like, stays in my mind as one of the most terrifying villains, mm-hmm. like, of all time. Like, from my childhood, like, seeing certain things. It was, like, this guy, the peeling of the face in Poltergeist, like, scared the crap out of me as a kid. And that stupid clown from Are You Afraid of the Dark? Hmm. Or like the, did you ever watch Are You Afraid of the Dark?
Yes.
Okay, so remember the clown from the first episode? Or the jester with like the jello that pops out of it? Yeah! But this guy, he makes such a good, convincing villain. Mm-hmm. Not even that many lines, honestly, like for the majority of the film.
An Indian actor. He shaved his head for this role and then ended up sort of keeping the shaved head throughout most of his career playing villains because it was just, it gave him such that brooding, brutal, iconic look. There is one thing he does that always throws me for a loop where I'm like, really? Is his little, like, escape trap door. Like, he cackles and then just, like, dips out through the floor. I always thought that was, like, just a little bit off key. Like, it's fun, it's funny, but it's like when they're giving him, like, his predecessor is giving him the tour of the evil shrine on his first day when he's like, an alkaline is yes, and then this is the trap door here in front of Kali's shrine in case you should be attacked.
Just when you need it. There's moments like that when Drew talked about, like, the shtick, when the hammer is, like, thrown and, like, hits someone in the head and it's like, dunk. I'm like,
no.
Wait a minute.
His
skull
should be open.
Yeah. No, like, there was a sledgehammer that just went into this guy's dome and, oh, he's just, like, a little, like, wah, wah. But,
and
yeah,
I think that's reflected a little bit in the scoring by John Williams, which the music, if you listen to the soundtracks from Raiders of the Lost Ark and Last Crusade, they more dovetail together more, whereas the Temple of Doom, it seems like he's injecting a lot more of like the 50s sort of like space soap operas and some of the, you know, the first action with really overdoing a lot of the score during the action scene to make it less intense as far as, you know, this, that we're rescuing child slaves that torture each other and human sacrifice and all that stuff.
Fair enough. I mean, it can definitely go along with music accompanying a little bit of the shtick, especially it's all like, we're not falling. We're crashing. To which my brain is like, I don't care how fast that thing inflates. I don't care. You're hitting solid ice. Like, that's not going to be comfortable for you.
And Kate Capshaw's character isn't her fault.
No.
They wanted to make a character, the female lead, the complete opposite from Marion in Raiders of the Lost Ark. And also they wanted each movie to feature a different woman, which it did up until they started doing like the, I want to call them like the 20 years later sequels.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because they, you know, obviously
a lot of time has passed.
Yeah.
So they wanted her to be the opposite, but if you make the opposite of Marion, then you get Kate Capshaw's character.
No,
which is, you know, a lot more screaming, shrieking.
The screaming. She did not know that she was going to have to scream that much.
71 times.
Yeah.
Wow.
She was not aware exactly also like how she was going to scream that much or how to do it properly. So she had to like almost do it on set. And along with screaming, the bug scene, she was doped out on Valium just so she could actually get through it.
There was a scene
where she had to grab the snake and stuff.
But I love that scene when they're playing cards and she's just like going fucking nuts around the campsite.
They're arguing.
I do. I love that scene.
The scene is great. I know that Spielberg, like, I guess he altered something because her just seeing the snake, he could see her hands like so dramatically shaking. But then, just like probably Nathan, like, I love the fact that all those bugs would not be living in the same space. But that's moot because the audience doesn't care. They're not seeing normal cockroaches. They're seeing giant Madagascar hissing cockroaches.
Or undulating waves of cockroaches.
Yeah, and a shit ton of crickets, and you have like giant water beetles, and you have leaf bugs and stick bugs. Like no one cares. It is just a mirage of all these bugs. 30,000 bugs.
50,000 didgeridoos.
So there were 30,000 bugs.
Spielberg
for that
used
first
50,
scene when they first
50,000, like Moses. Yeah.
So he started filming with 30,000 bugs in that scene, and then every day they would account. They're like, 25% of the bugs are gone. We don't know where. They just they're gone now. So he constantly
used the cockroaches.
Like,
the dead
like
cost nothing
because they were going to run out of bugs. But that is my favorite scene in the entire film. And it's all like, ew, it's sticky. It's like, hurry up, Willie. Hurry. Okay, Willie, we are going to die. That is hands down my favorite
moment.
Well,
and Short Round does such a good,
ever.
Good job of just adding enough comedy of just kind of like, hey, this is not on me. You told me to do this. Like, don't, you know, yeah.
You told me to sit against the wall. I didn't do this.
Hey, lady, no time for love.
I think
you
their relationship, you know, at very key moments really impacts on how much he cares about his allies that he has in life. You get to see a little bit of Wuhan in the very, very beginning, which, okay, total missed
the
opportunity. Why would they not use
Club Obi-Wan?
Wait, what?
So the opening scene takes place inside of Club Obi-Wan, which is a little callback. You could see it in neon letters after he jumps out the windows and they're pulling around the corner. But yeah, it's Club Obi-Wan.
But what a missed opportunity to ever do like a kind of like early Indiana Jones and like the adventures of him and Wuhan.
So like, I wonder, Nathan, because I've never watched him, like The Adventures of
Young. They're on Disney Plus.
I know. So I've never watched The Adventures of Young Indiana Jones. I'm wondering if maybe that character is inspired from that, although they did come later. But I'm wondering if maybe they went back and added something, because he does that line where he says, like,
we had so many adventures together.
Like, we had so many adventures together, but now I go into the great unknown first.
I have the biggest issue with that, because there's, like, the pilot in the Raiders of the Lost Ark. And like even in Dial of Destiny, there's
the old other professor.
So Hindi has a history of like
sure
sort of cast off, the sidekicks, but Short Round is an outlier in the Indiana Jones movie because it's the only time we get the kid sidekick.
True.
You know, because there was, you know, the dad in
yeah, he's the kid.
Last Crusade. Then you've got fucking Mutt in Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. And then you've got like the daughter of the same archaeologist in Dial of Destiny. But it's the darkest of all the movies. And I feel like Short Round's a badass. Like that one scene where he leaps off and he's like climbing up the rope through the goddamn hole in the ceiling. Mm-hmm. He's kicking adults.
Hey guys, slick
he's
shoes.
Fire at Indy. He's throwing fire at the Maharaja.
And the Maharaja, like, I remember him from the dinner.
I remember the stories.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's almost like Sebastian, call out my name.
In my kingdom,
But I remember the Maharaja from the dinner. And then I remember the Maharaja from the torture scene. And then when he's like voodoo dolling Indiana Jones. And the voodoo doll is kind of out of left field. I don't know much about Easter.
And you just whipped that up out of note. You're like, okay, he needs a little leather jacket. So let's get him a little.
No, he's had time.
Yeah. But I didn't realize because pretty much 90% of the times that I've seen this movie, it was in like the 1980s edited for TV ratio. And so during the sacrifice scenes, in my the versions I watched growing up, you couldn't see that he was seated on a pillow across the chasm watching.
Oh, you couldn't
and participate like that. That was either like severely cropped out in the version that I grew up watching that we had the VHS for. So it made a little bit more sense. But I also thought they could have developed that character a little bit more. Rather than like you're like burning him with fire at the end, and he gets like about like 30 seconds to 2 minutes of I'm no longer evil, and then it's just like take the left tunnel.
What if it would have been like a thing where obviously the high head priest is all about Shiva and Kali, okay, but the Maharaja's just a sadistic and creepy little fuck where like the guy's burning it on fire and he's just like
all the people all like it's like a rock show to them. They're just like fuck yeah. Woo! Burn baby burn. Yeah.
the arm wiggles back and forth. Like everyone's got poodle arms
have little,
all
like,
of a sudden.
Sticks they pat together like at a rock concert. Play Freebird.
When they show the stones, where he pull out the heart, they're like, yeah.
But the Maharaja and his voodoo doll, like after he gets burned and he's like no longer evil, like I wanted him to like pull his sash open like an old timey, pickpocket, and he just has like a row of voodoo dolls, and it's like because if you're evil, like other evil people are gonna piss you off, so like he's got one of like you know the slave master that Indiana Jones is finding, like plucks that up and like, you know, pulls his turban out and puts it between two rocks or something. That would have been badass.
Could you imagine like he, you know, like everyone's leaving for the night and then like the colonel bows and he's all like, good night, colonel. And then like the colonel leaves and he opens up his vest and he pulls out a colonel doll and he just walks to his little chambers. That's it. Like nothing more. And then the next thing you see is like the colonel just like, lying down and like gripping his chest as the kid's just like
another little fuck off thing I want to say is instead of which I do love the scene when Indiana brings her the fruit but it should have been the smooth talking English accented major domo that shows Indy to his room and they do a take on the Last Crusade and this Dr. Jones is how we say goodbye in Germany and like and this Dr. Jones is how we say goodnight in Pencott Palace. And then, bam, there goes the thuggy assassin with the Garrett. And what load-bearing ceiling fans they had in that palace,
baby.
Man.
The architecture in this place is impeccable.
A note to that. I don't know who or where, where they got the people to build this palace. Or, you know, when they decided to throw it all together. I want to know, I know it's been 100 years since the last, like, thuggy, like, cult gathering.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, who misses an entire sacrificial chamber beneath the fucking palace? So hold on. That means that Pencott Palace.
But like you think that they would like maybe check the blueprints before that and go oh shit this was a shrine to a dark lord before this interesting
has everybody
we'll renovate this
has everybody in Pencott Palace been like part of the thuggy cult then because that's the only thing that makes sense to me
except for the woman that's singing the nice song during dinner I'd like to think the band had nothing to do with it, just like Jabba's Palace.
Maybe.
No. But also, is police that are like non, you know, Tomb of Annihilation entrances to the fucking the place? Like they.
Well, there has to be. There has to be, because how are they getting? They're not bringing the children in through the palace. They're bringing them straight to the mine, and to and you go, you get to the mine via like different chambers, an offshoot from the sacrifice chamber. And to get to the sacrifice chamber, you can go through the secret passages
to the shrine of the silver monkey. Yeah, no. Olmec, give me 30 seconds on the clock.
Well, but if we're going to get that deep into it, Balaram tells Indiana Jones that they hid the other two stones in the catacombs. They hid them. They didn't hide them inside other rocks. So, like, what are they mining other things? Because if you're looking for stones, you don't need a rock crusher, and you don't need kids chiseling open, you know, basketball-sized rocks.
Well, cults don't run on their own. They have to sell.
This is true. Gift shop.
They got to sell some.
No magazine subscriptions for Pencott Palace.
Is primo gifts.
But that's the other thing. If previous cult members from 100 years ago hid the stones within the mines, then obviously they would have been already at accessible locations, you would think. So, right, you're right. Like, where and what are they digging for? And even towards the end, like, he doesn't really seem... I mean, it's all a bluff when he's all like, drop the stones, Dr. Jones. They will be found.
You won't. Can we get a shout out to Dan Aykroyd being just a small, super small little part me off guard? I'm like, wait. Dan Aykroyd's in this?
It was the last play I could find. Yeah, it's a tiny, tiny little role for Dan Aykroyd.
Kid Lizzie. So this was the shortest distance traveled in any of the Indiana Jones movies. They only went from Shanghai to India. And it also featured no mention of Marcus Brody. And Indiana Jones did not actually touch any snakes, unlike any, or was confronted by any snakes. He only was, they sort of played on the cobra statue at the shrine of Kali. And he sort of, they, you know, he like pulls his hat down a little.
When Willie, yeah. When Willie so throws it, the snake, he's like,
okay.
Yeah.
True. But he doesn't actually touch
He's not confronted.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And then the only other thing I want to say as far as inconsistencies is during the opening scene, which I adore. Mm. It really was a good idea to open it with that musical. And I love that scene in that Shanghai bar. But when Willie goes running back through like the smoking hole in the theater, where does she go? Because on the other side, she's suddenly in like, you know, the tap dancing and like the line of girls that are, you know, ripping out.
But the audience doesn't remember, doesn't see this.
The audience, like, and when you see the building, it's there's windows right behind it. Where did she go? It's like, it's just like a pocket dimension that she ran into where they do different song and dances for like,
it's a mini verse. And you power my car.
We've been waiting in here with fog machines for hours. Mm-hmm.
But also juxtaposed with that, you know, this is one of the few true collaborations of George Lucas and Steven Spielberg.
Mm.
You know, there were only a few of them before they, you know, Spielberg kept on directing, but Lucas really started more taking a hands-off approach as far as that.
Yeah.
But there is a certain magic to how these movies are shot, how they sound. And how they're edited, you know, with like the, you know, machine gunning, the rolling, what the hell is it called? Banging the, it's not a cymbal, but
oh, gong.
Yeah, the rolling gong, and you know the machine gun. You know, they throw out a few Wilhelm screams. Just the gunshots And the you know, the squibs that are going off, the ricocheting bullets, like, you, we don't get those sounds anymore. They were only really in these early Indiana Jones movies. And then they just sort of either they were over imitated or it just, but God, they're beautiful.
There is one Wilhelm scream when Mola Ram falls off and he falls to the alligators. Yep. Like, the Wilhelm scream has already happened effect. After he's been ripped apart.
Well, I mean, just like the guy whose heart was ripped out, but he's still alive. You know, there's a little magic in there.
Magic.
Just like his little getaway trunk. His little getaway.
He'll never find me.
You know, pop down. Again, but that goes back to like that the 1950s, like, you know, the serial, you know, black and white bad sci-fi movies. And fantasy movies.
I feel like at the end of this, I want to put like the whole, like, just take it. Take a little piece of my heart now, baby.
And apparently all the women in the village, the Indiana encounters,
yeah,
can't have babies until they're like after 50.
Childbearing years.
I did not see one single woman of childbearing
age. It's been a hard life. You know, the land was robbed of its...
What are you talking about? This energy. Woman's 25.
But you notice as soon as, like, all the water was released and the kids are being brought back, like, that land and crop, they started getting green real quick.
Yeah, I know. Did Samwise come by and plant a tree? What's going on here?
This was a destitute place.
I'm sorry, I'm going to repeat the same quote again. This is more food than these people see in a week. They're starving.
All right, segments?
Segments.
Everyone's missed that. All right. First one. Monkey brains. Willie and Short Round are not impressed with the food at the palace, which produces screams and even fainting for Willie. Is there a dish from a film that you've always wanted to try, or perhaps a television show? You want to go first?
I'll go first. Okay. I'm going to take Studio Ghibli off the board right away. Because I feel that, and I don't think either of you guys, I think that was a bit too obvious on the nose. The cheese.
All
right, I've got two more. The cheeseburger that Ray Fiennes makes in The Menu.
Ooh, The Menu?
Yeah.
Ooh. Damn good choice.
Cheeseburger. But did you guys remember it was an old Saturday Night Live fake commercial with Andy Samberg, Jason Sudeikis, and Bill Hader called Taco Town?
No.
So the three of them are at Taco Town, and it's narrated by Chris Parnell, and they can't just eat the taco because it keeps on getting more and more and more overdone. They're like, oh, you know, we've got our seasoned beef and a crunchy corn tortilla shell that we cover with nacho cheese and our famous spicy Southwest sauce. But that's not it. Then we wrap it in a flour tortilla with refried beans. And then we wrap it in a gordita shell with jack cheese. But wait, that's not it. Then there's a crepe filled with eggs, merguez cheese, sauteed mushrooms, and Gruyere cheese. Wait, there's more. Then we wrap it in a Chicago deep dish pizza. And finally, a blueberry pancake that we batter and deep fry and serve to you in a tote bag full of vegetarian salsa. And like they're showing the evolution of this taco over time. And I would, even the end taco, I would eat the fuck out of this taco. It's only two minutes long. If you go on YouTube and you search Taco Town SNL, it's a short, sweet commercial that just gets better and better and better.
Fair.
But yeah, those are my three. Those are my picks.
My picks would be the imaginary meal on Hook. Every time when I was a kid, I loved that feast. And
I was with you there. Thinking that.
That almost made my list.
When they're like first kind of just grabbing and they're like biting imaginary food, you're like, oh, like, what are they eating? Does it smell good? And then when it reveals, hot damn, everything on that plate and that table, I'm just like, I'm there. I'm all about it. And my second one would be the Jurassic Park banquet that Tim and Lex go and feast upon and just kind of like double spoon up. And they're just going to town on different like Jell-Os and stuff. The Jell-O not so much, but I love Tim's little moment where he just like kind of like hobbles into the Great Hall and is like, I'm eating all of this shit. Those are my two.
Okay. For quite some time, I have always wanted a good burger.
Oh.
And I want a good burger.
Not a Krabby Patty?
With lots of good burger sauce. And the feast from Hook almost got me, but I'm going to go with a little bit more magic, but I'm going to go with like the Hogwarts opening night feast.
Harry Potter. Boom.
Because
I'd go Hogwarts breakfast any day of the week.
Oh, yeah. Lots of sausage.
I mean, Ron getting down on some of those chicken legs. I mean, just going, nom,
oh, no, the Ron Swanson in the strip club with the breakfast buffet, where he's like flipping pancakes onto his plate and like the high pour with the sausage gravy. Like my wife and I have watched that episode many times. She's like, "That's fucking you. You're not paying attention to the women in the strip club. It's the fucking breakfast bar." I'm like, "You goddamn right, honey."
Or Wedding Crashers when Vince Vaughn is just like, "Okay, I'm gonna recharge," and he's just like pouring syrup over the whole entire plate. He's like, "Gonna need a couple minutes. Just, you know, don't talk to me." Yeah, good stuff.
Mom meatloaf, you know.
All right, next segment. Finish him. Halima! Halima! Probably one of the most impacting moments to ensure a man's death is in movie history for me at a young age, as I have made a point of addressing several times during this recording. What is a notable killing move from a movie that you always imagined yourself doing or lives rent-free in your head? It could be from a movie, TV show, video game, cartoon, whatever. I'll start from this one. There is a there's a horror movie from the 80s. I know, shocking.
Or just a horror movie general.
No. This is very specific. It's an eco horror movie called Prophecy, and it's about this this big bear that has like been kind of affected by toxic waste.
Man, bear, pig.
I mean, almost. But he, like, hits this girl who is wrapped up in a sleeping bag for safety to try and avoid this giant, massive bear. And it flies across the campsite, hits a tree, and then explodes.
Whoa.
So this thing, it's always been one of my favorite, like, kills in horror. And I just think it's just absolutely hilarious.
So mine, I didn't go with anything that I would necessarily do, but what lives rent free. And I'll skip the first one because the first one's just kind of like an honorable mention. And I Still Know What You Did Last Summer, when I believe it's not Tyrese Gibbler, gentlemen, they're in the kitchen and he gets hooked through the throat. Not necessarily even really possible with your, spinal cord right there, but still very, very cool because it catches you off guard that he drops down and, like, hooks him. Whoa, that was crazy. Final Destination, almost any single lives rent fucking free in my head. I can think of any one of them at any time. Like, oh, yes. The teacher dying, just the random shit that's happening in her. I mean, like, just every single death in that is so much fun. And lives rent fucking free. There we go. Oh,
this is why we don't
logs
behind.
Fuck that.
full of lumber.
Full of anything.
No, though I have driven, overtaken a lot of farm trucks going down Taft Highway, and it's like onions or oranges. I was like, I don't know if that would really kill me, but. So
I almost put Red Leader was also kind of an honorable mention for me.
And it's rent free just for the gifts.
He's holding
that people have edited over the year, like the Doritos bag and the big gulp, or there's the one where it's like a chicken leg and like a big gulp and he looks like fucking Colonel Sanders.
Like it's so out of place, I think, for that movie, but I love it. And I overuse those gifts often. General Vogel from Last Crusade sailing over the cliff in the tank, and just the face on scene where his like torso is out of the tank and he's just the scream that he gives, not to mention like the special effects landing where like you can tell it's a dummy that's like hands are glued on to this model of the tank that they dropped off. That lives rent free. The only thing I could possibly imagine me doing is I use the quote from Batman. Have you ever danced with the devil in the pale moonlight? Because I love that last scene on top of the church steeple.
I would have guessed you as like Bagua, just like the end with that cutting out the heart, you know, the white man's.
It's hard to do again, but it's the gif of where he's like
powder is soaking wet,
trying to get the captive True, girl back segment. Away from the edge, like yep yeah, but no
all right, final segment, Mola Ram. This man haunted my nightmares as a child, and I am still convinced he's one of the best villains to ever hit the silver screen, as I have already stated.
I don't mind Who starting this one out because the two that I have, child one, I didn't realize I had today. Like suppressed memories of this film. Return to Oz, or you know, Oz 2. When I saw the trailer, I was like, wait, that looks very familiar. And then I watched like a whole thing about it, about like how like Disney's like really tried to like suppress it and not like, you know, strike it from a lot of their stuff. Because it's deep and it's weird and it's dark and it's not cool. And seeing some of the characters in it really brought back some like weird shit in me. I was like, oh, I remember as a kid, I was fucking terrified of the Tin Man, which is this like robot thing with these big weird eyes, and the Scarecrow, which has like a really like weird prosthetic face, fucked me up. Like, and I saw it and I'm just like, oh my God. Oh God, it's there. I remember. Like, and my body's going, no, suppress. We're okay. Hated it. The other one, very weird, I know. I would have reoccurring nightmares of this character. In Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, I know, this is going to be weird, Lady Fairchild. And I know this sounds so... so weird. I would have this reoccurring nightmare of being in this house where there's these like, little like toy railroad tracks. And Lady Fairchild would be with a knife riding a little train, and it'd be going through all these like rat holes, and like, and I'd be running around screaming, and she just would cackle and try and like cut my legs.
You better finish your vegetables, yeah, no, or else I'm gonna visit you tonight in the choo-choo.
Done. This segment's done for me. Go. Going back to therapy.
I really tried to, like, I spent some time thinking about this. What villains scared me as a child? Like, what gave me some true heebie-jeebies as a kid? And I had to reach pretty far back. Because as, you know, by the time I got old enough to be watching Nightmare on Elm Street and Friday the 13th, like, those are, like, it was more like, a little bit of comedy at that point. And I wasn't ever scared of, you know, Jason or Freddy. So it is the number one was Tarek the Marauder from 1985's Ewoks, The Battle for Endor. He was his makeup. Like he had like this creepy makeup. And he, the actor that portrayed them, really did a good job of sort of having a brutality and almost like a bestial side that like there wasn't any hope or humor or mercy that you're going to get from that character. Plus he killed off Sindel's like entire family. So definitely that one. And then my final one was Reverend Henry Kane from Poltergeist 3. So I was
that guy.
I was in an after school babysitter for a couple of years when we lived in Columbus, Ohio, and we would go to movies sometimes, and the babysitter's son, who was older, like in the fifth, sixth grade, had picked Poltergeist 3, which was PG-13. But I watched this as like a six-year-old, and it scared the shit out of me. Poltergeist 3. I hadn't seen 2, hadn't seen 1. But man, Kane in Poltergeist 3, that creepy old man scared the shit out of me.
He is unsettling. He is very unsettling. Yeah. I have gone over quite a few. Another came to mind that definitely scared me as a kid. The Gamork from The NeverEnding Story.
Oh.
As a kid,
that is a scary movie.
And you know what's weird? It's not even the Gamork when he like lunges out and attacks Atreyu or, you know, tries to kill him. It's the Gamork while he's like sitting in the shadows. And he just, and like, all you see is just like the teeth, the pink of the lips, and the blue eyes. That's it. Like, that was like creepy because it's one of those things that, like, if the room is dark, like, you could see it just staring back at you.
Well, and plus, when they would cut back to the kid,
those good segments,
you
though,
know, reading the book, and he's got his candles, and he's in like the basement of the school, and like, all of a sudden, the windows blow open.
Yeah. But yeah. All right. No, thank you for reminding me of my own segments. Well. Any last minute thoughts? Any excitement for the future? Nathan, I do believe you're up for the next round.
If you have it, Drew, I think the audience would really appreciate just a good recap of what we have left in each one of our arsenals to pick from. You know, just a good understanding. The audience, of course, you know, not us. We know exactly what we have, so don't even fucking question that. But just, you know, those that are maybe newly listening, all three of them, could definitely have a second to go, hey, this is what they were looking to accomplish a year and a half ago.
All right. So, Jack already did his Western with his Open Range. We have already had our domestic comedy with Jack with Raising Arizona. And
Wife and I are in Dutch. Better hurry up.
I brought y'all my suspense movie with Rear Window. Anthropological with Indiana Jones. And that's been me so far. Nathan, you brought us a political comedy with Black Sheep. And the rest of your genres, Nathan, we have a docudrama, treasure hunt, remakes, meta films, neo noir, and wilderness.
Okay, yes, yeah. I'm glad that the audience remembered those. Or that.
Jack has pregnancy films, but I do believe he has already made his pick for that, which if it's the same one,
it is.
Then I am fucking stoked. Ariel or Sky High, Snow in Winter, and I do believe that is also chosen,
there's
maybe?
There's two.
Okay, now there's two. That's fine. Black comedy or dark humor, and meat pie western. I still have Killer Kids, Anti-War, which I have chosen already. Reboots, it's down to two. Time travel, it's down to two.
So when you said time travel, I just heard like the little tinkling chimes from Back to the Future. Diddly diddly do. Diddly diddly do.
Or and finally, psychological phenomena films. So, Nathan, do you know which you're going to be picking, or do we get to maybe
Drew's Clues?
Bring back some Drew's Clues.
Oh, shit. Forgot about Drew's Clues.
Those were a thing.
I'm looking at Goto. Yeah.
So we do have a Patreon special for this episode. It's called
yes.
Sauce for the Goose. And this more derives from the minecart scene and the flooding thereof, which is a masterpiece of technical engineering, and was almost entirely the minecart interior was miniaturized. And then the flooding thereof, all practical special effects.
Mm-hmm.
And again, Lucasfilm, back in the day, Lucasfilm, before we got, keep it the same, keep it lame, make it diverse. So this is Sauce for the Goose for $5,000.
Oh, dear. Okay.
Just a pittance of $5,000.
Well, this is pocket change.
And a six pack of Tall Boy Modelos. That's not included in the $5,000.
Okay.
That's in addition to. I'll sit here like Matthew McConaughey from True Detective Season 1 and tell you why movies were objectively better in the 80s. I'll do a podcast or a live feed where I drink my beers and progressively slur more and tell you why modern movies are shit and things. Yes. And a lot of it, well, you do not need to let the public know about such things, David. But either way, you can watch me just like a cranky uncle tell you why eighties movies were bomb, and a lot of these new movies suck.
I like it, and
it's called Sauce for the Goose.
For this movie's Patreon special. And speaking of Patreon, everybody, if you'd like to join us over on Patreon, search for the Real Feels Podcast. Since we've kind of been in a hiatus for episodes, all of the payments have been in delay. But if you want to get on the ball and join us for the month of June, please join us up on Patreon. We'll have early episodes to get to you guys. We're going to finally get on to some of our Patreon specials that we've been talking about for a while, like our kids sports movies draft.
Yes.
Or Nathan's The Trial of Rebel Moon.
Yeah, okay.
I think that's a dope idea for what we can do. I'm gladly...
They're powering the ships with coal.
I will gladly take the role of prosecutor. I don't think I would be a fair judge.
It's gonna be like the Stokes monkey trial.
Nathan brought up the idea that you and I, either like one of two ways. I think either go episode by episode for Star Trek.
That's just impossible.
It's impossible. It would just take
it's a whole goddamn
time.
Podcast.
It's improbable.
Now
it's a whole other platoon.
Now I would propose
it's a whole other company.
I would propose maybe each of us maybe pick our top five favorite episodes.
I don't know. I love Star Trek too much. I don't know if I want to bastardize it.
Okay, and that is completely fine.
Plus, I'd have to watch a hell of a lot more Star Trek.
You would.
I already watch Star Trek.
That's true. If anyone would like to join along with something that I'm going to do for myself, and I'm going to put it up on Patreon in increments, I have challenged myself to watch all of my physical media library. So that's a daunting task.
You can always share your thoughts with this on the Tooch line, but I bet you won't. But you're still 6-1. Very welcome to. No one's going to answer the phone. Like, no one's going to, like, Drew's not going to pick up and be like, you know, we'll do cookies or some shit like that. It's going to go straight to voicemail. You can pick as, I think, as long as you want. Long-ish.
Long-ish.
Long enough.
You can definitely call the Tooch line, guys. 661-376-3030. Call the Tooch line. Let us know what you want on Patreon, your specials, or just say hi. Tell us your favorite part of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
So from right now, or sorry, from the moment this episode is dropped on various platforms until the recording of our next episode. So you got a good solid week and a half, 2 weeks.
Something like that.
If somebody calls the Tooch line, I will rub my erect nipple over the spit filter on my microphone. Because that's how I feel about it.
That's got some
that's
pop.
How I feel.
Oh, gosh. And speaking of various platforms, guys, if you want to go and leave us a nice, you know, 5-star review on Spotify, head on over there to Apple Podcasts. We would love another 5-star review. It gets
landing gear.
Ooh, landing gear.
That's a callback to episode one, goddammit.
That's a season one joke, guys. You can go back.
That's pre-Jack.
That's pre-Jack.
That's pre-Jack podcast. That's...
But guys, go out there, leave some great reviews. It gets the riffles out there to more people. And yeah, so thank you for joining us for this episode of Anthropological Genre with 1984's Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
A stone. You must get the stone.
All right, guys, thank you for joining us. And as always, you're the realist.
And the feelist.
Shiva Lynn.